The Guardian.
And welcome to Guardian Daily on Tuesday, June the 3rd. I'm Esther Adley, and coming up on today's podcast, world leaders are gathering in Rome for a UN summit on the soaring price of global food. It's certain to be a lively meeting, not least because of the extremely controversial presence of Robert Mugabe.
His presence here has been criticised as one of grandstanding and an absurdity.
Britons could generate as much energy as five nuclear power stations if homeowners and businesses were encouraged to put solar panels and wind turbines on their roofs.
Maybe 10 million people would be prepared to do this, given the right incentives.
The anti-globalisation campaigner Naomi Klein has been in China, where she witnessed how that country is developing new technologies that will allow it to keep an ever closer eye on its citizens.
There are cameras everywhere in the cafes, not just like one camera at the door, but directed at every screen.
But first, the headlines and a look at today's papers with Sandy Warr.
World leaders open a conference in Rome today to discuss what to do about the world food crisis. The World Bank and human rights campaigners say action, not words, are needed to avoid a global catastrophe involving more than 100 million people. Oxfam says world food prices have gone up by 80% in 3 years and that £7 billion is needed for immediate assistance. We'll have more on the conference later in Guardian Daily. A man in his 30s has been arrested in South London after a 15-year-old girl was found stabbed to death in a block of flats near Waterloo Station. The girl, believed to be of East African origin, was found in a lift. She'd been stabbed several times. She's the 16th teenager to have died violently in London this year, and police launched new measures to deal with knife crime only last week. More than 400 children taken from a ranch run by a polygamous sect in Texas are being returned to their families. Police raided the ranch in April after allegations of the sexual abuse of children on the ranch. Social workers then took away all the children from their parents, who are members of a sect which has broken away from the Mormon Church. But the Texas Supreme Court has ruled that removing the children was not justified. At a court in the earthquake area of China, police had to drag away parents protesting at the death of their children. The parents carrying photos of their dead children were protesting that the children died in the earthquake because their schools were badly built. The confirmed number of dead in the earthquake is now just under 70,000. Rescuers are still dealing with draining lakes formed by landslides, which are now threatening many more homes. In Burma, 1 month after the cyclone, the UN says that 1 million survivors are still without basic relief. Aid workers say they're still being held up by government restrictions in taking staff and equipment to the disaster area. They say many still haven't got enough food to eat. Three papers this morning carry photos of Zimbabwe's President Mugabe in a surprise visit to the food summit in Rome. The Guardian quotes a British foreign minister who said, "This is like inviting Pol Pot to a human rights conference." The Times says one European official suggests we could save grain for food by restarting the feeding of animal remains to pigs and chickens. Other papers put the stabbed 15-year-old London girl on their front page, while The Sun shows former footballer Paul Gascoigne slumped in a chair with the headline, "Please save him." More on the day's news plus breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
World leaders are in Rome to talk about what everyone else has been talking about for weeks, the soaring cost of food. With rocketing prices causing riots in more than 30 countries, they've certainly got lots to talk about. The Guardian's diplomatic editor Julian Borger is there, and earlier he spoke to John Dennis about the likelihood of agreement at the summit, and also about one delegate who nobody was terribly happy to see, Robert Mugabe.
Well, Mugabe's presence has been particularly controversial because his economic mismanagement has been widely blamed for the food issues in Zimbabwe. And Zimbabwe should not only be able to feed itself, but be a big food exporter. And because of the collapse of Zimbabwean agriculture over recent years, and the overwhelming analysis is that it's just simple government mismanagement, Zimbabwe has been a country on the brink of hunger and malnutrition. So his presence here has been criticised, particularly by the British government, as one of grandstanding and an absurdity. One British minister said it was like Pol Pot going to a human rights convention.
What are the options for the world's wealthiest countries?
Oh, for the wealthy countries, what they're being asked to do is start investing in agriculture, particularly in Africa. But they're also being asked to look at their own consumption priorities. They're being asked in particular to look at the use of corn, mostly in the US, for biofuel, for corn ethanol, and whether that makes sense from the environmental point of view, but also from the point of view of food, because 40% of American corn is now being used to create ethanol rather than food. So there's an element there. They're also being asked to look again at their lifestyles, whether Western consumption patterns, which are now being copied in India and China, are sustainable from the point of view of the world's ability to cater to them.
The World Bank announced a rapid response fund last week to help the world's poorest countries. What other short-term measures are there that will help people immediately in need of food?
Well, food aid is number one. Also giving out inputs like fertilizer, like seeds for the next harvest in places like Africa, where people have gone hungry and have eaten the seeds and not been able to afford the fertilizer for their next harvest. So you're storing up problems for later in the year. So at the same time as giving out food, there's a call to give out those kind of inputs. Also to stop export bans, because the instant response of some governments has been to stop exporting rice and other staple foods. And that's contributed to the volatility in the market and fed into speculation on world food markets. So those are some of the instant responses they're looking at this week in Rome.
Is there anything approaching agreement on what to do in Rome?
Well, on the easy things, yes, that it's a good idea to bump up food aid and aid to farmers. On the longer-term issues, no, there isn't really. The US Secretary of Agriculture, Schaefer, has just been here defending the US emphasis on corn ethanol, claiming that it only fed into, it's responsible only for 3% in the rise of global food prices. Now, that's a figure that many here will take issue with, and it's going to be one that's going to be argued over the course of this week. And perhaps that's the biofuel issue is the most contentious. But there's also the issue of trade, whether free trade is the answer to this crisis, or one of the answers to the crisis, or whether it will worsen it, as some activists say. US and Britain, particularly Gordon Brown, has set a lot of store by a new round of trade liberalisation called the Doha Round as being one of the ways out of the crisis. But critics have said that may just, in the short term and medium term, actually lead to a rise in the price of food staples, because when poor countries in Africa are able to export money and make money from exporting food to the EU, that will raise the price in domestic markets in Africa and in the developing world. So it may not help, activists say. So there's a division over the impact of free trade and over biofuels. So those are probably the two hottest issues at the Rome summit.
Also on the Guardian website today, Ken Livingstone hits back at Boris Johnson's decision to cancel his oil deal with Venezuela. Read what he has to say at guardian.co.uk/comment. The American painter Cy Twombly discusses his work in a rare interview with Nicola Sirota, guardian.co.uk/arts. And relive the career of the late, great Yves Saint Laurent with a gallery of his work at guardian.co.uk/inpictures. Diego Garcia used to be an idyllic atoll in the middle of the Indian Ocean, but that, of course, was before its citizens were shipped off somewhere else so that the US military could build a base there. It's still a British territory, though, which means that Britain still has responsibility for what happens there. And now the Conservative MP Andrew Tyrie has made a formal complaint about the government's conduct after two American rendition flights, carrying prisoners whom some campaigners argue may have been tortured, were allowed to refuel on the island. Duncan Campbell is covering the story for The Guardian, and I asked him what exactly the complaint was about.
It relates to the two prisoners who were rendered through Diego Garcia, and about whom there's still not an enormous amount of information as to what happened to them or even who they were.
David Miliband's been previously forced to apologise about giving wrong information about Diego Garcia, hasn't he?
He has. He originally claimed that nobody had ever been rendered through Diego Garcia, and then he was forced to apologise and say that he had been misinformed, and in fact two prisoners had been secretly landed at Diego Garcia, at the US base, and he apologised for that, and it was not an intentional misleading of the House. Now he's under pressure to name them and to say what happened to them. And I think Andrew Tyrie's position is that we should know exactly what happened to them in case Britain is in breach of the Convention on Torture.
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? I mean, what do we know about these individuals and how they've been treated?
There's some supposition. Clive Stafford-Smith, the legal director of Reprieve, has suggested a number of names, and two candidates are Mohammed Saad Iqbal Mardni, who was a dual Egyptian-Pakistani national who was arrested back in 2002, and another is somebody called Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi, who was also arrested back in 2002 and transferred to the USS Bataan, an American Navy ship, which at that time was thought to be near Diego Garcia. So he's another possibility. Other names have been put up. And the reason that Miliband is under pressure is that until we know exactly what happened to them, there will always be a suspicion that something bad has happened to them.
And we're talking, as you say, about potentially Egyptian-Pakistani nationals under the control of the Americans. But because Diego Garcia is a British territory, that's why Miliband is involved in this. Can Britain really have any influence on this procedure, this activity?
Well, some of this will be discussed actually at the House of Lords later this month, because the situation of the Diego Garcians, who were evicted many years ago in the 1970s to make way for the US base, is going to be decided finally by the House of Lords. But yes, Britain, it's still a British territory. It's part of the British Indian Ocean territories. And therefore, Britain has responsibility for anything that happens on the island.
And it's potentially not just the fact that two planes have landed and refueled there. Isn't that the case? That there are suggestions that there may be other activities that have taken place on Diego Garcia?
There's very strong suggestions that people were held there and interrogated, not necessarily with the knowledge of the British authorities. And that's, again, why Miliband is under pressure.
Now, imagine if your little flat or your big, messy, leaky office, instead of sucking up energy and chugging CO2 into the atmosphere, could become a miniature power station, producing all its own fuel and selling anything extra it makes to the national grid. It sounds far too good to be true, but that's exactly what a report commissioned by the government is suggesting could happen in 10 million homes and offices, producing as much electricity as 5 nuclear power stations. I asked The Guardian's environment editor, John Vidal, how the scheme might work.
It's basically little wind turbines, it's solar panels, it's photovoltaic panels, it's mini dams in rivers, it's heat pumps, it's all kinds of different technologies which produce small amounts of electricity, but if they're attached to housing or to buildings, can actually together produce a huge amount. And what this report has shown is that given the right subsidies and incentives, Britain could be producing as much electricity from its homes as 5 nuclear power stations within 20 years.
I mean, it sounds like a completely brilliant idea. Why aren't we doing it already?
Aha. Well, no. The Conservative Party has plans for it. The Labour Party is considering it. And there is a big review of what can be done over the next couple of months. So coming up will be some policy there. The problem they've got is that they just haven't come up with the incentives yet. The incentives have been shown to work in Austria, in Germany, all over Europe. Here, we haven't tried them out yet.
So what you're saying is my, you know, smallish flat in a mid-sized town in Britain, my big out-of-town office, by putting technologies in those places, I can be contributing to the national grid. What sort of things would they look like?
You can become a little power station in yourself. And I've been in houses which actually do that. Basically, you can have what's called a combined heat and power boiler. This is a boiler which doesn't just produce the heat for your central heating system. It produces electricity as well. These are coming on the market very, very soon. And any excess electricity can be put into the grid. What this report is arguing is that if you're paid enough to generate the electricity, then that can come off your bills. So it's just that what this group which is arguing, and these are energy companies, is that given the right incentives, Britain could actually become a nation of power generators.
And what are the right incentives that you mentioned?
Well, what needs to work is some of them can be quite expensive to install. So there's two things, one of which you can either have upfront grants to help you put this stuff in, or you can be paid a decent return on any investment you make to actually produce the electricity, or you could have a loan system. You could, and they're even considering mortgage type loans, like the government would effectively subsidize soft loans, very low interest loans over 15-20 years, and that would allow a whole, they're talking millions, maybe 10 million people would be prepared to do this given the right incentives.
The report has been commissioned by the government. Are they going to do what it recommends, do you think?
They're going to have to do something because Britain is completely out of step. And actually, the Labour Party is also out of step now. But all the opposition parties are convinced that this is the way to go. If you are to meet your emissions or even get anywhere near your emissions, you've got to use every possible way to do it. And emissions from housing are 25-30% of the total. So if you can get houses to generate, then they will. So they're going to come up with something. Something will happen. It will get better. It has to get better. But quite what? We'll have to wait a couple of months.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
6 years ago, Pat Regan's son Danny was shot and killed in Merseyside, after which she became a leading and tireless campaigner against gun and knife violence. But tragically, the co-founder of Mothers Against Violence has been found murdered in her own home in Leeds, having been fatally stabbed. Martin Wainwright sent this report from the scene.
I'm in Marlborough Grange in Leeds, where Pat Regan was found murdered. It's probably the most central estate of social housing in Leeds. It's right in the middle. It's a run-down 1960s estate of small maisonettes and one large tower block. And Pat lived in one of these maisonettes up at the top. It's all sealed off by police, blue and white police tapes. The communal landing of the maisonette, which it shares with others in the little four-storey block and then a neighbouring four-storey block, is all screened with plastic sheeting. West Yorkshire Police have arrested a young man who's understood to be Pat Regan's grandson, who had a history of mental conditions and was receiving treatment as recently as last week. On the unmown grass outside the maisonette, bouquets of flowers are gradually adding up. There's about 20 there at the minute, and passers-by occasionally call by and leave more, because Pat was well known in Leeds as the local organiser, the chair of the Mothers Against Guns campaign, which attempted to discourage young people from getting involved with criminal gangs using firearms. There's a car just come over from Manchester with a group of women from Mothers Against Violence over there. Mothers Against Guns was the original title, then it became Mothers Against Violence. First of all, here from Jackie Featherstone.
Pat was a staunch campaigner against anti-gun and knife crime. She worked tirelessly, often on her own in Leeds. You know, she would say it was a mom of her own, but we're doing the work, and she'd be in the schools. She'd be talking at government level. She sat on the Home Office Guns and Knives roundtable with the Home Secretary, and she was a woman that was very direct speaking, very passionate about the issue, and she really was putting her all in all to making a difference in Leeds. She was a very generous individual. She was very loving and very straight speaking. As you met Pat, as you said it, that's how it was. There was no airs and graces. And she was just a beautiful person, and it's such a loss.
What was the reaction among young people to whom she spoke?
They loved Pat. You know, she was very genuine, and that always came across, and very sincere. And so she really touched people's hearts. She really did. She was a lovely woman.
Angela Lawrence was one of Pat's main allies over the other side of the Pennines in Manchester, and she paid tribute to her friend.
People use the terminology like salt of the earth, and all I can say is that I met Pat 4 years ago, and I was drawn to her instantly. And we've laughed together, we've cried together, we've worked hard together, and I'm going to miss her.
Journalist Naomi Klein is best known for her 2000 book No Logo, which became a sort of manifesto for anti-globalisation campaigners all over the world, examining how major corporations operate in developing countries. Now Klein has turned her attention to China, and specifically to the economic boomtown of Shenzhen, where the communist government is developing new technologies to allow it to be even more repressive. She spoke to John Dennis.
What's important to understand about Shenzhen is that it's always been a laboratory. Shenzhen as a city didn't exist in 1980. It was chosen as one of China's first special economic zones. So it was a small fishing village. And now is a city of 12.4 million people. And it began as this experiment in capitalism. And the theory was, when it was turned into a special economic zone, is that China would hold on to its socialist soul, but in this special area, the rules of free market would be allowed to apply. And then the idea was to get the benefits of capitalism, but contain its negative side effects, like some sort of toxic waste inside the zone. Now, as we know, this experiment in capitalism was so successful that it spread to the broader Pearl River Delta. This is right across from Hong Kong. There are 100,000 factories in the Pearl River Delta, roughly. And basically, chances are that almost everything that you own, or maybe three quarters of everything you own, was made in one of those factories. Your computer, your iPhone, your iPod, your jeans. I mean, just everything is made there. And what I'm showing in this piece is that Shenzhen is once again a laboratory. It's a new kind of laboratory. It's a laboratory for the surveillance state, or a kind of police state 2.0. The Chinese government has decided to road test a series of technologies like biometric IDs, network CCTV cameras. There are going to be 2 million CCTV cameras, and the idea is to network them all, and the cameras are both in public spaces and also in privately owned spaces, but all of them networked. And this is what's different between London and China. In London, you do, as you know, have a lot of CCTV cameras, half a million, and more than anywhere else in the world. But you can't have this level of integration between public and private cameras, which is what they're doing in China. And there hasn't been the integration of facial recognition software and biometric IDs that they're trying in China. So Shenzhen was born as a laboratory, and it is a laboratory still.
What kind of private spaces will host these CCTVs?
They already do. Internet cafes, what they call entertainment venues, which is everything from karaoke bars to restaurants, religious sites as well, are required by law to have CCTV cameras. There are cameras everywhere in the cafes, not just like one camera at the door, but directed at every screen and feeding directly into the local police station. And the other way in which the internet cafes are under surveillance is that now in Guangzhou and Shenzhen, you can't get online without a special first of all, showing your national ID. And then with that ID, you get a new special pass card, which you use to get on the internet. And what that means is that your surfing can be under surveillance. And if you are somebody who's been tagged or flagged by local authorities, if you're on a blacklist, then as soon as you log into the computer, then theoretically an alarm goes off, and your activities are monitored.
Can you tell us about Golden Shield? Because this is the sort of Chinese state system that brings together all these different kinds of technologies to create this kind of 21st century Big Brother.
Exactly. Golden Shield is the name given to what we're describing. It's the networking of all of these surveillance technologies. And this is, you know, this is the big difference. It's not the tools themselves, because there are places in Europe that are using biometric ID cards. As we know, there's an incredible proliferation of CCTV cameras. We know in the United States that there's been a great deal of cooperation between the big telephone companies to hand over email correspondence, to do warrantless wiretapping of phones. And there are several lawsuits going on about that now. What Golden Shield does is it integrates it all together to create this shield. And this is an attempt by the Chinese government to have the benefits of the information age without the risks. And of course, there are great risks to an authoritarian regime if their people are able to get access to any kind of information they want, but also use these tools of the information age to build movements. In recent years, there's been a major spike in protests in China.
Two years ago, the small French village of Fromel was right on the front line in the Great War, with Germans squared up against British and Australian troops. Unfortunately, as they had a habit of doing, the Allied generals made a number of dreadful tactical blunders, and so many of their troops were slaughtered that it's been called the worst 24 hours in Australia's entire history. For Britons, the Battle of Fromelles was largely overshadowed by the even more catastrophic Battle of the Somme, which was going on at the same time 50 miles to the south. But this week, archaeologists have uncovered the mass graves of hundreds of men who died there in July 1916, but whose bodies were never found. The Guardian's Maeve Kennedy was there to witness the excavations.
Well, what they have found is five trenches at the bottom of a sloping field full of ripening corn, a very pretty field on the edge of a forest, a very calm, tranquil, very French rural scene. And at the end of the slope, there are these five pits, which they suspected and have now just proved are full of human bodies. They're the remains of hundreds of young soldiers who died in a battle that people have almost forgotten in this country and remember vividly in Australia, which happened at almost the same time as the Battle of the Somme in July 1916. So it was hardly reported at the time because there was such carnage just down the road from it. Some of the bodies were never recovered because the sites weren't properly marked. And these were among the ones that were just, the grave was never found, the incident was half forgotten, and there they remained for 90 years until the first human bones came out of the trench this week.
So what happened? Had they started looking again, or did someone stumble across them? How have they uncovered this grave?
The story of the Battle of Fromelles was never forgotten in the area because the village was completely flattened in the fighting and totally rebuilt after 1914, so they never forgot it. The Australians remembered it because it's been called the worst 24 hours in Australian history. Between those who were killed, injured and lost in the fighting, 5,500 young Australians died. They say within 24 hours, really within 6 hours from the time they were pitched into this completely absurd attempt to cross 408 metres of no man's land and take the German lines. But the grave was dug by the Germans. Some of the bodies were left lying in no man's land and, according to people I've been talking to today, lay there for 2 years in some cases. Others died on the Allied side before they ever got started. But in the confusion of the times, the gravesite wasn't precisely mapped and people went looking for it in the wrong place and then gave up. And what happened was some Australian historians got interested in this long-forgotten battle, started looking at the records and realised that all the bodies weren't accounted for. In fact, 399 bodies weren't accounted for, and that is probably the number, about two-thirds of them Australian, that are in these pits on this field in France.
Were there British casualties at this battle?
There were British casualties. There were altogether, there were about 1,500 British that were killed and injured. About a third of those altogether, I think, probably died. But it was the percentage of Australian casualties in terms of the total number of Australian war deaths that was so shocking. About 5,500 between the killed and injured, which was about 1 in 10 of all of the Australians who died in the entire First World War were lost in this one miserable little skirmish.
And Maeve, there are family members who have been attending the archaeological dig. Are they likely to be able to identify which of the corpses belong to their ancestors?
They may. At the moment, what they have done, they're doing a very limited excavation. They have proved that the trenches are there and that there are human remains in five of the trenches. And so far, they haven't found anything that individually identifies people. But one man who was there, his little daughter, Tim Whitford, his great-uncle Harry is the only person who has been definitely identified as being in that pit. And by a most pitiful irony, it's because the little town in Australia that he came from, near Victoria, gave the soldiers who enlisted for the Great War good luck medals as they left. And it's Harry's good luck medal that has turned up in this trench and that proves that he's one of the people buried in it.
And that's it for today. Phil Maynard has been your producer and I've been Esther Adley. Thanks for listening.
Downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.